In our conversation earlier in the programme about bullying, the notion of restorative justice came up, and as it happens, we're going to expand on the notion of restorative justice, and it's an entirely different way of dealing with crime and conflict in our communities. It's based on a theory of justice that considers crime and wrongdoing to be an offence against an individual or community rather than necessarily against the state. It's practiced in many countries, including the USA, Canada and several European states. And it's a subject that will be discussed at a public lecture in UCD tonight, Restorative Processes and Serious Crime. And that will be facilitated by Professor Mark Umbright. And Mark, who's founding director of the Centre for Restorative Justice and Peacemaking in Minnesota, joins me in studio with Dr. Marie Keenan of the School of Applied Social Science in UCD. Marie's also a psychotherapist who has used restorative justice in specific cases that she has been dealing with. You're both very, very welcome indeed. Marie, to you first of all, give us an example or give us an idea of what restorative justice is, perhaps by talking in general terms about some of the cases where you have employed this process.
Well, basically, restorative justice is a way of responding to the harm that is caused by crime. And there are many different practices under this umbrella term, restorative justice. And one way of working with it is by using victim-offender mediation, i.e. bringing the victim of a crime and the offender together. You can expand that by bringing the victim of a crime and not their particular offender together to do some work together. You can also expand that by bringing the victim and his or her family and the offender and his or her family together to do some dialogue and conversation. And then you can have what's called healing restorative circles, where community members, as well as offenders, as well as victims, come together in a circle to heal. And so I've been involved, and Mark has been involved, but I've been involved in at various levels with all of these kinds of processes, if you like. But the main thing about restorative justice, before we go into specifics, is that it puts the victim and their hurt back at the centre of the process, and you really attempt to respond to the harm that has been caused. But it also affords the offenders an opportunity to, if you like, pay back and try to play their part in healing or helping to heal the hurt that they have caused.
And does it always complement the legal process, or does it occasionally supersede the legal process?
In various jurisdictions there are different ways of operating this, but and certainly for a very minor crime it may well be as a diversion process, and some of the Gardaí have this now in place, you know, that for very young offenders that it might be a process that would bring the victim and offender together, and that it would go back to the court, and court would say this is fine, that this has been done in this way, that the young person has tried to repair the harm. But for more serious crime, and that's one of the areas that we'll be discussing over the next two days with Mark here, for very serious crime there is no question that it would supersede the normal regular criminal justice system. It would have to go hand in hand.
Give me some practical examples of where you've employed it.
Well, I've worked with a young girl and her father, now a young adult, where her father had sexually abused her when she was a young girl. And they had been estranged, and the father was in treatment for his offending, and the young woman had had treatment for her victimisation. But as life went on and she was going to be married and move into relationship, have her own children, she had a feeling that she wanted to actually meet with her father. They had been estranged, as I said, and to try to hear his apology, if you like. And she wanted to ask him questions like, why me, Dad, and so on and so forth. And so that was a process, if you like, that I facilitated between the father and the daughter. And then the mother came in on this as well.
And what are you hoping to achieve there?
What you're trying to achieve
with all sides.
Yes. Well, first of all, for the victim or for the survivor, what they're trying to achieve is, first of all, they're trying to let the person, some survivors are very different. Some want to let the offender know excuse me, you have really, really hurt my life and harmed my life in this, this and this way. And I don't know if you've ever thought about that. For some survivors, they want to say the exact opposite. They want to say, excuse me, despite your best efforts, you did not take away my life. I am bigger and stronger than this. And then for some survivors, they want to ask questions of the offender, like, have you ever thought about this and this and this?
Okay, the way you you're expressing that makes it sound as if there's not much in it for the offender. So why would the offender participate?
Yes, no, there is a lot in it for the offender, and the research we'll go on to talk about that in a few minutes shows this. For the offenders, they have an opportunity, sometimes for the very first time, to absolutely hear face up to the effect by having the other person in the room, the effect of their crime. And that's a transformative process. I've witnessed it, Miles, with my very own eyes. It's a transformative process of the heart that these men just get it, in my view. A lot of them, now obviously there are exceptions, but really get the effect of their crime on the other person. But secondly, it offers them an opportunity to, if you like, offer an apology, a heartfelt apology. It also offers them an opportunity to see what they can do to repay and repair the harm that they've caused. And the intention is for the offender and for the survivor and for the community is that these men and the survivors take their place back in the community again, because this is a community problem and we cannot be running victims underground or survivors underground or marginalising them, and we cannot be running offenders out of the country. We need, this is a community problem and they are of us.
But I mean, the community in the case of the incidents you just, I want to come on to Mark in a minute,
yes,
but in the case of the incident that you've just described, there will be many in the community would say, we're not interested in reintegrating the offender. All we want done is that they are rendered harmless in some way.
Yes, well, I mean, many of these men will have therapy as well. But the evidence from the research, from Mark's research, and I'm involved in a sexual violence project at the minute, but the evidence from research now internationally is that it decreases the recidivism rates of these men. So it does make them safer. It also reduces the fear for survivors in the aftermath of crime, and it also reduces their post-traumatic stress. And I've certainly been involved in healing circles. I've just come back from the United States, which is a different kind of a model, but where you absolutely witness transformation in place.
Mark, this is something that has been around for about 40 years or so. When you came to it, did you take some convincing before you actually took it on board?
Yes, I did. For many years, I had worked with prisoners and ex-offenders, getting them jobs. We developed an organization to set up the first halfway house to help men coming out of prison get reintegrated. When I first heard about this, I thought, well, maybe it sounds like good ideas, but I thought it's not realistic. It really won't work. No one in the community would want it. And then we started working with young juveniles, and it seemed to have quite an impact. Then we started working with young adults, and I would witness it. And frankly, that convinced me more than any books or intellectuals would. And we slowly began getting requests, which shocked us, from victims of severe violence, parents of murdered children, children of murdered parents, adult children, who said, well, this sounds good for a burglary case or vandalism or a fight in a school, but what about me? My son was killed or my father was killed. And from the beginning, working with violent crime in America has been victim-driven. When I did the first victim-offender mediation with a murder case in my state of Minnesota in 1993, not a single legal jurisdiction in North America or anywhere in the world had formal protocol to allow it. It was absolutely taboo. Today, there are more than 27 states in America that have formal protocol that allow it. If the victim initiates it, if the offender agrees, it's absolutely voluntary for both, and if there's a program that can deliver it. There are thousands of cases being done today.
And again, is there something in it for the offender? And is there a danger that the process might be used by serious offenders to improve their chances of more favourable treatment, including perhaps even early release?
Yes, there are some benefits for the offender. But every,
other than psychological.
Oh, yeah. But every effort is made to avoid the manipulation of the system. That is one of the strongest items in the protocol in America, that there's no connection to whether you participate or not in a victim-offender dialogue and early release from prison. I have had tough, convicted, violent felons say to me, the hardest thing they ever did in prison was not being in a solitary prison cell. They know how to deal with that. It was going into a room, agreeing to meet with the mother of the young woman they murdered. That was the most frightening thing they ever had to do.
So why would they do it?
Well, many of them don't do it initially. That's why in doing this, it takes many months, even years, to prepare the victim and offender. And if the offender doesn't want to do it, it's not going to happen. The single most common reason I've found in my research and practice is it's their own way of almost doing emotional restitution, of trying to make things right. They've come to a point in their lives realizing how the harm, the incredible harm they have caused to someone. And if this act can help the victim, they agree to it.
Do the offenders often initiate this process themselves?
Well, that's an interesting question. Sometimes they do, but in order to avoid unintentionally re-victimizing the victim, all of the states in America have clear protocol that it must be victim-initiated. If our systems of justice ever become totally restorative, maybe then it could be, you know, offender-initiated too. But I want to make something clear about restorative justice. Some people get the idea this is some flaky, way of letting people get off easy. I would submit restorative justice is far more real. It's going back to old-fashioned principles about crime is wrong and people need to be held accountable, but we can also promote healing within communities. And that's why it's neither liberal or conservative. I never thought I would be alive to witness what I'm witnessing in my own country and in the international community. And I believe it's because it's tapping into values that people, despite political ideology and different cultures, it makes sense.
Yeah, you've operated obviously on a micro level, but you've also operated on a macro level. You initiated a Palestinian Jewish dialogue group in Minneapolis, St. Paul. Tell us about how that worked and how that incorporated elements of restorative justice.
Well, it has to be totally reframed, because you're dealing with deep, long cultural conflict. I would use a peacemaking circle called a talking circle, which actually uses a talking piece. It comes out of the traditions of the indigenous people of America, our Native Americans, and it in no way solves the problem. Restorative dialogue, I have to be real clear, I don't want to overhype this. Restorative dialogue creates a safe place where people who have been harmed by political or criminal activity can talk about the real human effects and can try to work out a plan to repair the harm. Let me give you an example of a much larger macro issue. I'm working with the United Nations Development Program and the Turkish Ministry of Justice. They have passed national legislation in Turkey to develop victim offender mediation throughout the country. They've asked myself and a team of international colleagues to come together to help them with that process. I'll be going back in December to be training more and more volunteers and be working with their prosecutors and judges.
You've also worked with people who are involved in hate crimes, for example.
Oh, yes.
I think specifically anti-Muslim, more than rhetoric, anti-Muslim threats. Just tell us a little bit about that process. What happened there?
Well, 2 hours after the 9/11 terrorist attacks on America, a young man on the west coast of the United States was full of the anger, the disbelief, the numbness that we were all feeling. He knew there were Muslims in the community. He didn't know how to deal with his anger. He got the phone book. He looked up the number for the Islamic Cultural Center. He called that number, and the imam answered, and he just spewed out all of this hatred. You know, you Muslims, you get out of the country. You should all leave. You've hurt us. I mean, I'm not even saying all of what he said. And then he called up a mosque, and it was just an answering service, but he still left a message of hatred. And he was easily traced. And when the police caught him, he admitted to it. He was ashamed of what he did. He had no criminal record. And the prosecutors in that area were totally supportive of restorative justice. They referred this case to a neighborhood accountability board. They thought this was a more real way of holding this guy accountable by allowing community people to be involved. Many, many months of preparation, And the first meeting was not dialogue. It was awkward. It was like breaking the ice. There are community people. There is the imam and his wife, the young man who did this. They wanted a second meeting to see if they could go further. And at the second meeting, it was really transformative. the imam finally could look this guy directly in the eyes. He couldn't before. He let him know the incredible impact it had on his community. The young man totally owned up to it, and they worked out a plan to repair the harm. He agreed to write a letter of apology to the Muslim community, printed on the front page of the main paper in the community. He agreed to, I think, 300 hours of community service work, speaking before civic groups and high school groups, other school groups, about what he was involved in, how that's not the right way to deal with anger. And most importantly, he agreed to go to 3 lectures on Islam. This young man was from a Christian background, and as most Christians, myself included, in my earlier years, had not a clue that Christians, Jews, and Muslims were all related. I mean, literally, we're all children of Abraham. And he sat in the front row with the imam and his wife, and he learned about the incredible values of Islam and how they parallel values in other religions. Now, the religious theology is different. That's when you get intellectual. But the core spiritual wisdom of that tradition is incredibly similar.
And you have also worked in the United States of America. Just tell us some of the, Marie, some of the things that you have been involved with there. Again, we're, I suppose, returning to the micro level. For example, I think you were involved in a process where a woman who was out jogging and was raped at knife point met her rapist.
Yes. Well, no, not her own rapist, but I've just come back from the United States where I was taking part in a restorative justice healing circle, one of the peacemaking kind of circles that Mark was talking about. Well, not peacemaking, but healing circles. And in this, there were 25 incarcerated men, and there were 20 then community members. And, you know, it's a 3-day intensive thing, building up trust and so on. But on the second day, there were a number of victims survivors came to talk to this group of men. And one was a woman who'd been out jogging in the morning time on her way home, 2 blocks away from her home, and was held up at knife point and taken away in a car and raped. And that woman, it's a number of years ago, she's had therapy and so on, but she comes into the prison to talk to these men about the effect of this and how her life has been and so on. And she's clearly recovering and recovered in very many ways. But what I asked her afterwards, why does she do this and whatever? And she said, it's actually part of her own healing, that she comes in and does what she can to try to prevent other men going this route. She also finds it enormously heartwarming, if you like, when she sees the effect on the men that they can get their heart around the trauma that some of them have caused. And she also finds it really important for her that she is doing her bit, if you like, as she sees it, to prevent other crime happening.
Does this have application to the subject that we were discussing in the first half of the programme, to bullying?
I think it absolutely does have relevance for this, and particularly the kind of community circles and the teacher, a couple of teachers, and the, we'll call it, bully child, the child who's bullying, and then the child who's being bullied, and maybe their parents. And as Mark said earlier, it might not all happen, the miracle, so to speak, in the first meeting, but you can build it up slowly, and maybe in the second you have the transformative process, and then you can also have a plan to repair that harm. I think we really need to get creative now in this country about how to respond to the harm that is caused by bullying, by crime, by serious crime, and by, you know, all these things that we've been talking about this morning.
You were nodding, Mark, when interested in relation to bullying. You think it has application, does it?
Oh, absolutely. It has applications in many settings. So much of what we do, we think we're being tough, and we're really not. We're spending lots and lots of money, precious money that we don't have in our economy, on programs and interventions that there's little evidence they have much effect. You know, most people are not aware of the research on this. There's clear evidence that restorative practices, especially victim-offender mediation, have a significant impact on recidivism reduction, particularly with juveniles, but there's also some with adult studies as well. Tremendous effect in terms of victims feeling more respected and helpful in the process. You know, just recently I did a murder case. A woman who came to me 22 years after her father was viciously murdered in St. Paul, Minnesota. She was full of anger and hostility. She thought it was behind her, but it was just eating her soul out after all those years. She went to our Department of Corrections, and they quickly referred it to me. They didn't want to deal with that anger. I spent Actually, in that case, I spent 2 years preparing her and then meeting the man in prison who had killed her dad. And I wasn't sure if it was ever going to come together, frankly. But she finally did want to move forward. She initiated it. And it was very awkward initially as we went into the prison room. And I have to make something very clear. In these violent offenses, the offender is always in prison with rare exceptions because of the nature of the offense. Mm. It was awkward initially. She began telling her story about the impact of her father. He was very uncomfortable hearing that, you could tell. I mean, he didn't think of that at all. Then he began telling why he did it, and he didn't make excuses. He was ashamed of what he did. Her husband was with her as well during this time. The conversation went back and forth and back and forth, and it didn't end in a way that fixed everything. No, that would be naive to think that. But it lowered her level of anger and trauma enormously. And she later said, in fact, tonight you will meet her in my lecture in a film that I'll be showing, Pam. You know, she can't use words like forgiveness or transformation, and she almost chokes on the word forgiveness, but she definitely communicates how she feels so different, you know, having, after all those years, confronting that man.
The thing about restorative justice, Miles, is it's victim-driven, but the offender has to accept responsibility for the crime in order to be eligible to take part in this. So when you got that bit going, you certainly have something kind of to work with. But you were asking, Mark, why these men, the offenders, take part in it. Why would they do it? I would answer, because they're human. And most of us, whether we've done wrong or not, we have to put our head down at night. And for most human beings, in my experience, at some point or other, we feel that we want to make amends, if you like. And that's why I think a lot of the men take part. And I think why the survivors take part is because they know that after redress boards, after prison, after crime, after courts, after therapy, there's still something that needs to be done. They often need to meet these men who did this to them.
Okay, well, it is, as you say, a good way in which perpetrators can demonstrate their humanity. Thank you both very, very much indeed for talking to us this morning. Marie Keenan and Mark Umbright. Restorative Processes and Serious Crime is the title of the public lecture. That takes place tonight between 7 and 9 o'clock at Newman Theatre in UCD. And that is essentially, it's a free lecture. Anybody can go along. But there is also a series of seminars. And if you are interested in getting involved in the seminars, contact Ingrid Colvin at 086 85 66 114. 086 85 66 114.